Vítáme vás u dalšího dílu podcastu Insider, který moderuji já, Michal Půr a můj kolega Tomáš Jirsa.
Dobrý den.
Na začátek pár obligátních vzkazů.
Partnerem tohoto podcastu je American Academy, americká mezinárodní základní střední škola v Praze, projektová výuka zahraniční učitele, výuka STEM a studium pouze v angličtině, advokátní kancelář Rowan Legal. Každou středu poslouchejte, a někdy i čtvrtek, a někdy i úterý poslouchejte náš formát Insider Briefing, kde se věnujeme různým aktuálním věcem. A dneska máme speciální díl, kdy jsme tady v Kumbálku, v improvizovaném studiu na Shifts Prague 23, což je taková velká konference, která nás konfrontuje s děním ve světě. A my jsme si tady trošku vynutili jednoho z nejzajímavějších speakerů a hostů. Kdo to je?
Je to Sir Alex Younger, nejdéle sloužící šéf britské rozvědky SIA, známé též jako MI6. Od roku 2014 do roku 2020 byl důstojníkem MI6 na Blízkém východě. So, Sir Alex, it's great to have you here.
Welcome to Prague.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. My question: we had a prep call for the conference for your speech, keynote speech, and it was I believe it was Thursday before the hell broke loose on the Middle East, and it all seemed, you know. Situation is pretty stable. Ukraine is kind of tiring people. It's, you know, it's 2 years ongoing. Everybody's used to it in Europe. And it all started shifting towards business as usual. And then this happened. So how big of a shift, if the conference is called shift, does it represent?
This is the depressing thing, Thomas. It's not a shift at all. So I'll talk today about things that are and the way in which I think we're at a turning point in some really important phases represented by the rise of China and the nihilism of Vladimir Putin. But this has been going on for a very long time. And the only surprising thing really is how we've been able to ignore this situation and convince ourselves that, you know, that it had gone away. And that was self-evidently not the case. Now, I'm as guilty as everybody else. When we were talking, I probably was feeling quite optimistic at the time, given the process of normalization of the Abraham Accords taking place, particularly between Saudi Arabia and Israel. It felt in some ways like we were at the dawn of something changing. But of course, we've been violently and horribly reminded that that is not the case. This is not something that will solve itself.
Yeah, I see in Czech public discourse two general views. One is we had 30 years in our case after the fall of communism of peace, growth, stability, international order, and it's over. It's over, and the era of uncertainty of wars around us and security threats rising. The other view is it's business as usual. Okay, there's war in Ukraine, you know, some shakeup in the Middle East, but overall we'll just go through it and, you know, it's not a big shift. So where you stand in between those two quite opposing views?
It's I'm afraid to say, a mixture. So I have a background as an intelligence officer, a spy, and that has had two effects on me. One, an understanding that this idea, the thing you were just talking about, Thomas, that history had ended, okay?
Yeah.
That democracy had triumphed, that we were in some postmodern world. I've always known that that wasn't true, okay? In my world, Vladimir Putin or our other adversaries, they didn't get the memo about
the
triumphing. And we were in a pretty well constant struggle, really, since the beginning of this century. So this idea that a postmodern world where you could separate geopolitics and economics never felt very real to me. And therefore, the fact that history hasn't ended, we're back in a time of ideological contest, this feels to me like This is the normal, and it was the past that was the recent 30-year past that was the abnormal. But secondly, I am a human intelligence officer, and that actually imbues you with great faith about the power of individuals to change things. The whole business model was based on the small group of people making a very big difference.
Yeah.
And I see all around me that happening. And the 30 years of freedom you have enjoyed here is arguably that happening. And it is impossible not to be fundamentally optimistic when you look at the intrinsic strengths that have driven this amazing period. So I don't think there's any scope for complacency, and we need to understand the challenges that exist around us. But my advice always is actually we need to remember the things that keep us up, make us strong, and we need to double down on them. You know, and I know what they are, and we need to use them.
So you've spent many years in the Middle East. There are some debates about the situation that if the situation will evolve to the regional war, or will it be just the case of Gaza Strip? How bad is the situation? Because my wife often asks me how bad it is, and I am not able to give her an honest answer, because it feels like you are on the brink of World War III, as I would say. You can't tell her.
I think that it could be bad, but I think that people are working quite hard to ensure that it isn't, more perhaps than I would have expected. So, you know, why did Hamas do this? Well, it's a good question. It's an act of nihilism, really. But of course, terrorism isn't the action in the end, appalling though this action is. It's the reaction. They're attempting to stimulate a reaction from Israel and the Israeli government that essentially throws the country and then the region into turmoil, thus improving their position. I think this is the warped logic that is in their head. So this question of escalation is fundamentally something Hamas is seeking to achieve. And I think both the Israeli government and the American government understand that. So the Israeli government are enraged. The Israeli people are enraged. This is an act of terrorism, pure and simple. And they will, and I believe that they have the right to strike very hard against Hamas to destroy the infrastructure that allowed this to happen. I hope, though, and I believe, in fact, they will understand that they can't just respond to the script that Hamas is writing for them, and that this needs to be done in a way that doesn't make the situation even worse. Because to answer your question, if this leads to a broader uprising in Israel involving the groups in the West Bank and then pulling in Hezbollah, you are in a very dangerous situation at the moment. If that happens, looked at from an Israeli perspective, you've got three issues. You've got Hamas, you've got the West Bank, and you've got Hezbollah, all of which basically have Iranian support. And Iran starts to be the consistent problem that you face. And I think the risks of escalation in those terms become higher. Also, of course, there is the possibility that something emerges that demonstrates that Iran actively directed the attack from Gaza, which I think would also be extremely incendiary. At the moment, it doesn't look like that intelligence exists, and I hope it doesn't exist. And in practice, I believe that Iran are responsible. They trained and financed Hamas. I don't actually believe that they direct their operational activity, but we will see.
I started to become nervous when the United States decided to move the second ship, the carrier, to the air, which signifies some, you know, that it is maybe a level up in seriousness and you know, in geopolitical scale. So how you kind of said it, you don't think there is. It's a very coordinated and synchronized attack, but it's hard to resist this kind of idea that, you know, with all the traditional adversaries and allies and Vladimir Putin struggling in Ukraine and the situation being kind of deadlocked, China trying to, you know, outmaneuver the US globally, and then suddenly you have this kind of big escalation that draws a lot of power from American military and Europe as well. And you really have to focus and kind of drain your resources. Is there any idea. Maybe it's purely on ideological level, but do you see this kind of possible synchronization of these, you know, traditional adversaries of the West?
No, I don't think that's what's happening. One of the insights you get from 30 years intelligence is it's normally not a conspiracy. It's normally a cock-up.
So I'm not sure if this is like calming.
Absolutely. So I mean, actually, bottom line is I think that Hamas never expected to be this successful. Wow. So a set of essentially accidents meant that Israel was not well prepared for what happened. I think everybody missed the change in the quality of the capabilities that Hamas bring to this. Hamas is actually acting out of weakness, essentially. This wasn't a sign of strength. They're feeling marginalized, particularly in the context of the Abraham Accords. I think they achieved much, it was also catastrophically overachieved in their operational objectives and set us on the cycle which we're now on. I think you should be reassured by the presence of the two carrier groups in the Eastern Mediterranean. The reality is carrier groups are not useful when you're hunting down terrorists. But when you're looking at a quasi-state structure like Hezbollah, they're an excellent way of deterring what might happen next. And it's Hezbollah, I emphasize this, it's Hezbollah's entry into this that brings... that is going to worry your wife, and quite rightly.
Yeah. Okay.
So that is a parastatal unit that you can deter through the threat of the use of air power. As to how all this fits together, I don't think there's any sort of idea of coordination. But to be absolutely sure, to your point, Thomas, it will be exploited to the full.
Yeah.
And in this axis of resistance, as it's now called, which is North Korea, Iran and Russia, you have those three countries now bound together in their opposition to everything the West stands for. It's very noticeable. Russia's taken a surprisingly hard line. Normally they try to play both ends, but they've been really clear this is Israel's fault, and they're supporting what has happened. And that is a sign that they see an opportunity for sure.
How do you interpret the what people perceive as a very ambivalent approach of Israel to the situation in Ukraine, which was probably understandable with the explanation in the region and situation in Syria and all of this, and need to have some communication channel with the Russians.
Yeah.
So in that context, now this very, I would say, firm and very clear message that the Russians are sending, how...
Well, in a sense, I would hope that reveals to the Israeli government the need to take a position. So they, I've been very clear with them. It is a mistake.
Yeah.
To try to you can have a pragmatic relationship with Russia for sure. Everybody needs to do that.
Yeah.
But you need to understand what you've got here. Now that the consistent argument that Israel employs in these circumstances, which is a function of its terrible history, is that it has a particular duty to manage its security environment. The reality is, because Russia has a dominant position in Syria, they have to find ways of at least coordinating. There's a very significant Russian diaspora, and. But yeah, I think this is an example. But ultimately, Vladimir Putin's regime is not a regime that you can even find really a tenuous set of reasons to work with.
Yeah.
Head of Shin Bet intelligence service said yesterday that it was his failure, his personal failure that this happened. Do you see that as an honest answer?
Well, it's a brave answer, and it's a dignified answer. In fact, I think it's more complicated than that. And by the way, the whole sort of concept of talking about intelligence failures is something that makes me very uncomfortable. You know, I am a former practitioner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whilst I believe we should all acknowledge failures when they occur, the one thing that we all have sitting in our nice seats in this warm studio that you do not have at the time is hindsight. And we need to be very careful using the judgment of hindsight. It is not available. You know, I was in charge of our counterterrorism efforts for a long time, and you do not have hindsight. You have to go in a very uncertain and difficult and dusty and muddy environment. And that is where these people are working all the time. Now, clearly, at the sort of technical level, there do appear to have been a set of issues, and I imagine that is what he is alluding to. But really, if you look at this step back, it's not just an intelligence failure, it's an imagination failure. You know, the reality is that 70% of the IDF was in the West Bank when this happened. There was, I think, a sense, a conflation of what the Israeli government wanted to be true and what was true. They wanted Gaza to be on the back burner so that they could focus on a set of more political agendas that they had in the West Bank. And of course, the chaos, the squabbling in the Israeli government cannot have helped when it came to allowing people to focus on their job. So I think it's more complicated than a technical failure on the part of the intelligence services.
When we look at the broader picture, do you think the real shift is that in perception of people like Vladimir Putin or terrorists from Hamas or, you know, anybody opposed to what we enjoy here in the West, all these things, either Ukraine and all this testing of our willingness to invest in our defense, came at a moment where they sensed pretty rationally that Europe, with maybe its very nice and very ambitious plans for, you know, Green Deal and the future that will be absolutely different, while being extremely dependent on Russian supply. Maybe Israel being torn between, you know, not civil unrest, but the very, very weakening process of protests against the government and internal disputes. So is this the time where the enemies kind of sense the very fragile, very open wounds that they can exploit?
Yeah, I think that there's something in that. I know that Vladimir Putin said that the US was in the same state a couple of years ago when Donald Trump was in charge, that the Soviet Union had been in before it fell apart. He had convinced himself that the dysfunction he saw in Washington was a sign of an underlying weakness. Now, that is obviously completely wrong, but that is the way that his mind works. Xi Jinping, for his part, is genuinely, he's more sincere than Vladimir Putin. He genuinely believes that socialism with Chinese characteristics is emerging as a superior alternative to what we talk of as liberal democracy. That is not actually synthetic. He thinks that. Now, some things have emerged to prove those assumptions wrong, and specifically in the context of the Ukraine war. So my colleagues and I, you know, we were very clever. We predicted exactly when Putin was going to do this and told the world, you know, clever us. But what we didn't predict, or certainly what I did not predict, was the quality of the European response. Of course, initially, Zelensky's astonishing discovery of his leadership talents and his ability to pull Ukraine together. But also, if you remember that speech that Olaf Scholz made on the first Saturday, where he talked about Zeitenwende and all of these things. And the reality is Europe, the European Union, the transatlantic alliance has proved to be far more coherent and far tougher than I expected, and crucially, than Vladimir Putin expected. So the terrible irony of what you've just said is if they had actually understood how strong we were, and if we had understood how strong we were, this wouldn't have happened. So you're completely correct. In a set of, frankly, appeasement measures for Georgia and in Crimea and in Syria, we sent a strong signal to Russia that we weren't prepared to stand up for the things that we believed in.
Yeah.
And it turned out, ironically, that we were.
Yeah.
Do you believe we will be able to keep the quality in our response, to keep the quality in our response to the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I'm super focused on this, and I've always worried that somehow the sort of governments and elites of Europe in particular are ahead of their people in all of this. But I don't know what you guys think, but, you know, after 2 years of this, it actually seems that there is real resilience here, and the energy crisis has enacted a real toll on people's livelihoods, and yet, broadly speaking, support is staying strong. Now, I think we are in for a very political year next year, as it emerges that there isn't a military solution to this close at hand, and given the position that some of the Republicans are taking in Washington. But I don't know about you. My expectations have been exceeded when it comes to popular willingness to support this. I come from a small village in the east of England, and every second flag on the high street is a Ukrainian flag.
Nice.
And those flags are still there.
Are we?
I think we feel the same. And the Czech Republic is, I would say, very exceptional in public support. It's overwhelming. It's, I don't know, between 80-90%.
Yeah.
I think Czech government was the first in line to actually sit on a train and go to Kiev, and when everybody else was afraid.
Yeah.
And I think Britain played, even outside the EU, a very significant role.
I think they've named a street after Boris Johnson.
Yeah. Oh, in Kiev.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, he was a big supporter.
He was right there
up until now. But the sense that I have is there was this crucial month at the start where nobody really knew what Germany is going to do. Mm. It was very open end question.
Mm.
And from that moment, we see what you're talking about is kind of unity. But still, there are, I would say, worrying signs. One is the absolute reliance on American presence and inability. I mean, again, I would say that in the Czech Republic, we just made a decision to buy the F-35s and invest heavily in our army, as maybe Poland did. But overall around Europe, if you look at the state of armies, of the defense structures, it's a sad outlook, and I think people, when faced with increasing costs and hard decisions, because it's either we buy the F-35s or maybe we spend on healthcare or other things, so that will create a big tension. And I think it's but from my point of view, there's really mixed signals from the European leadership with regards to this, maybe the Green Deal and its adapting to reality and support for humanitarian aid for Palestine. And so isn't it still that you kind of don't have this one number to call somebody in Europe and get a decision? Isn't that the problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's undeniable that the situation in Washington, well, it must be the thing that preoccupies Zelensky more than anything else. And there is this extreme possibility of Donald Trump getting elected, and that is perfectly likely that he gets elected, and then following through on some of the promises he's made to stop the war on day one, which can only mean stopping it on Russian terms. And that would be a disaster for Europe because, as I think we've all agreed, stopping the war on Russian terms isn't going to make our continent less dangerous. It's going to make it more dangerous because it will vindicate what he's done. And this is, very clearly unfinished business. Now, a lot would depend on whether Donald Trump followed through. The reality is that it would embolden China, amongst other things, and that's something he apparently cares about. So who knows if the rhetoric will match. And also, the really big one is what stopping support would mean. If it means essentially withdrawing the sort of security guarantees that are intrinsic to NATO, we have got a really big problem, but I very much hope that it doesn't mean that. So let's just accept, therefore, a reality. Even if Trump doesn't get in, there's a sufficiently active debate in Washington about this for Europe to have to understand that what you said is true. Increasingly, we are going to have to take care of our own security. Now, I vehemently hope that that's never out of the context of this deep interdependence with America. But fundamentally, there's an up arrow next to Europe owning its own security. And that has got a whole set of implications. Not all of them bad, by the way. I think in a sense, Vladimir Putin has done us a favor. He's reminded us that we do need to take responsibility. And I think we're already a completely different place to we were. But the reality is we're going to have to take decisions. We're going to have to grow our defense capacity and capability. We have, for instance, just seen the miraculous enlargement of NATO. So, you know, we have the structures to do this. But I think we're going to have to stand up. And that will be a question, of course, of political leadership, as I think you're saying, Thomas. But also, it's not like it's a difficult argument to sell. You know, this yeah. might have been an abstract idea 2 years ago. It really isn't now.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that regarding the Ukrainian war and the conflict on the Middle East, that it is the Europe who pays the price always. Always. It's not the United States. What we should do to be better, what we should do to make things changed.
So
are we lacking, is it the politicians or is it the society? What is it?
It's us. So this is the shift. There's been a shift. You know, this idea, I think in Europe we got carried away by the idea that we had tamed the forces of history. We're in some postmodern period. And we could afford to run down our military, increase our social spending, because the world was now a less dangerous place. Now, that was just wrong. What was actually going on is we were under a US security umbrella. Now, that is still a pretty formidable umbrella, but we're now discovering where the limits lie, and the US's ambitions are changing. So we now know that in the real world, our model is going to be contested more and more and more. And that if you take a simplistic view, as in Germany, that you can take your security from America, your gas from Russia, and your market from China. You know, that is effectively to ignore a whole set of geopolitical risks that come with that model that you can't ignore anymore. But we're all complicit in this, in the sense of the things we demand from our governments. So I think it's inevitably, it's going to take a while for reality to dawn. But I think, to go back to what I said at the beginning, there's also a process of remembering we have a set of things that make us really strong. So if you want me to know, if you want to say what worries me the most, it's not our ability to build up our defense industries and our military industrial complexes. I think, you know, we can do that. We've done it before. My view is that the real battle here is on the technology side, and there are a set of technologies growing, and the value system that dominates those will be the one that has the geopolitical power. And I think China has really worked that one out. It has a plan to dominate the key emerging technologies. America is now reacting. Where is Europe in this space? What are we actually doing to produce the next global innovations that will keep us at the front of this race? Because that is the thing that will give our kids choices.
Yeah. No, it's where I wanted to, you know, aim this next question, because obviously there's a strong correlation, unless you are North Korea, you know, between economic strength and strength of your business and capital markets and of course technologies and military might. I think it's undisputable that US is managing those two things on the highest possible levels, having, you know, open market economy and very strong innovation drive and investment in new technologies, and while at the same time maintaining strong military might and presence all around the world. The strange combination that China has, which is, you know, authoritarian, communistic, I don't know how to describe it, like authoritarian societal management with some mixture of free market, also proves that they're able, in technology-wise, to be at the top of the development. The worry about Europe is, and we just recently had an interview with an energy expert that said, you know, Europe is losing this kind of source of growth. Doesn't have any more friends in the world. USA being a friend and competitor as well. So where is this chance of finding this, so that the EU or Europe as a whole doesn't become some kind of a bumper area between two competing poles?
Yeah. I think that's kind of the most important question of our time. This idea of whether China can sustain its innovative potential whilst also Xi Jinping repoliticizes China, closes down the private space even more, and reduces the scope for private initiative, it's a really open question. It's possible that may be very difficult, but I don't think we should assume that China will fail because, as you say, it's bringing huge resources and a very long-term approach. I think the innovative power of US and its distributed system is undoubted. And the issue is us in Europe. I did not vote for Brexit. I do not think Brexit is a good idea. But in this respect, I now encourage my government to be as different from Europe as it possibly can be.